So let's talk about thinking then, Tom. I mean, most people think that when they think, it just comes from one place. Would you argue with that?
No, for a lot of people it does, actually. We've got a very left-brained society. The way that we're educated and the way that our society works tends to promote the idea or the pattern of thinking from the frontal lobes. So we've got that internal dialogue going, so there's no quiet space at all. Our education makes us left brain, our culture makes us left brain, and basically when you're in that left brain mode, your thought patterns are in your outer cortex. If you're not saying something like I'm doing now, you might be running over a conversation that you had in the past or thinking about something you're going to say in the future. And all that activity is in outer cortex. So for a lot of people, their thoughts are their own. They're internally generated. But it's possible to get into a state where the mind goes quiet and all sorts of wonderful magic happens.
Wow. I explain this because as far as I'm concerned, left brain is logic and right brain is creative. And I certainly know. I mean, I'm very young. I'm 54. There was no creative thinking when I was at school. Are you saying there's still not a balance of creative thinking?
It's got better. It's got a lot better as we understand more and more about the brain. We're the same age, by the way, Deb. So that's interesting. But basically, what happens is that the left brain, it used to be thought the left brain was logic and the right brain was creative. And that's entered our urban myth. But what's happened recently is all the brain research that used to go on was done on people that had brain damage. So either they had a stroke or some sort of physical damage. And then what happened with the neuroscientists was scan the brain, work out which bit of the brain looked like it was damaged, and then look at the function that was impaired and say, well, actually, that bit there must control this bit over here. But what the scientists have been able to do recently is, over the last 10 or 20 years, is anaesthetize a bit of a brain, either a whole left brain or a whole right brain, while someone's absolutely awake and well, and then to ask them how they're feeling. And what it looks like is that the left brain actually sits inside space and time and creates our idea of reality, and our right brain sits everywhere and everywhen else, so it sits outside time. So if you switch someone's left brain off completely, they go a bit sort of spacey and timeless. And if you switch their right brain on, then they're into detail, but they can't see the whole of things. And so if you think about it, if somebody's got their head in the clouds, they're very right brain, might be very creative, but they never get anything done. And if someone's very left brain, and can I say the word anal on air, is that possible?
You may.
Okay, so very into the detail, and our language gives it away, doesn't it? It's head in the clouds, devil in the detail. Yeah,
that's interesting. Yeah, head in the clouds, devil in the details. I like that.
That's
so
it.
The right brain kind of doesn't then take much notice of time and things like that. It relies entirely on the left brain to know where it is and what it's doing.
Yeah, and they're always communicating. They're always mediating. And there's a structure that connects the two bits of the brain, which is called the corpus callosum. And it's like a butterfly-shaped structure. And this guy called Professor Roger Sperry would sever it in epileptic patients in the 60s, and it would make them go quiet. And it would cure their epilepsy, but they'd end up with this situation where they'd be in, literally be in two minds about things. And if you...
Wow.
Yeah, so their left and right brains wouldn't communicate, and so they became quite dysfunctional as people, even though they now weren't epileptic. And so the real trick and kind of where we're going as people is to get the left and right brain working at the same time on the same thing. And we were talking just before we came on about Tony Buzan, weren't we? And I've got to say that mind mapping is just the best way of doing this, because the mind map is this thing. If you've never done a mind map, you've got a central theme in the middle. And maybe I'll put a link in actually to a mind map I've done in the chat room so people can have a look at one. But it's got a central image in the middle, which is the thing you want to think about. And then you have branches that come out from the centre, which are almost like neurons. You know, you put words on these branches and then you make associations from those words. And why mind mapping is brilliant for getting the left and right brain working is that it gives the left brain something to do. And the left brain says, you can imagine it, like, you know, remember numbskulls from those comics in the 60s? where you had those little men inside the head. You can imagine the left brain going, "Oh, maps, leave the maps to me. I do the maps around here." And while the left brain's busy, the right brain goes, "Brilliant. Left brain's busy. I'll sneak in and be really, really creative."
Yes, because I did Tony Buzan's mind mapping, and at first I found the hardest thing to get every single link down to one word. But once I did it, I used to do whole 3/4 hour talks at history with just those one words triggering everything, and it was amazing how one word could trigger 10 minutes talking.
Yeah, the whole thing. And I must admit that I don't do any of my talks with PowerPoint. They're all completely memorized, because like you, I do a mind map of them, and I just know the shape of the mind map. And you keep it in your visual cortex, and then you can just recall it very easily. Great for revision for kids.
And I suppose that's because it's making the two sides of the brain work together, which is more likely to bring about a locking in of the information, isn't it?
Correct. And
Now,
it
there's a
gets.
few people. Oh, sorry, go on, Tom.
No, but I say that this structure in the middle of the brain, it used to be thought that it was the communication structure that actually communicated between the two sides, but it actually is an inhibitor. So if it's on, you end up in one brain mode or the other, and the real trick is to inhibit the inhibitor, which mind mapping does really, really well.
Excellent. Now, somebody on here, one of our wonderful ladies that listens every week and always comes up with something interesting almost immediately, has said that sometimes she feels like her brain's running slow. And another one said they'd like a reboot. Why is it that you can feel like your brain is fudge? Is there a reason that you can get up some days and move mountains, and the next day getting out of bed is just too challenging?
Almost certainly it's to do with what you're eating and what you're drinking and how you're breathing. You mentioned actually, Nikki, I'd written two books. I've actually written four and a half. I'm writing two more this year. And
Of course you
my first non-fiction book was called Blocks, and in it is a chapter on called Food for Thought. And certain foods really activate the brain. But the thing that really, really activates the brain, and also the brain can get dehydrated. So if you're not drinking enough, the brain will slow down as well. So making sure you're drinking not coffee and tea, but enough water in the day works. But by far and away, the biggest thing that gets the brain active is the breath. And if the neurons, unlike many cells in the body, neurons don't store oxygen. So the only way they get oxygen is by us breathing. And there's a few breathing techniques. I'll put a couple of links in the chat room later on to some meditations that people can have a listen to. And there's a breathing technique. There's two actually. The one that you breathe through alternate nostrils, which is one of the brain gym techniques, and it's called pranayama in yoga. And breathing alternately through each nostril activates each side of the brain. But then also using your diaphragm to really breathe, do that belly breathe is great as well. And you can do a breath from the belly, where you imagine that the breath is going, let's say an alternate breath. On one breath, it comes up from below the belly, even though obviously your lungs aren't below the belly. You just imagine it does this. And you breathe in straight through the belly, through the diaphragm, up into the right brain, and do that three or four times. Then in the other thing you can do is breathe through as if it's coming from the right of the belly, up through your diaphragm into the left brain. And that really gives you a zap. Great.
Right, so you breathe into the right brain, then into the left brain.
That's it, yeah. But you're imagining you're doing it, right?
Right.
And
yeah so
actually,
that
yeah.
I could just imagine the whole of the chat room. I was going to say the whole of the chat room right now is probably breathing like we are, trying to work it out.
Oh, I tell
I think
you.
what worries me is when you said breathe into your right brain, I've realized I've been breathing into my left brain.
Yep.
What I've been visualizing is the other side of my brain,
And
so
it
I'm
doesn't matter if
obviously.
you get them mixed up, and all these techniques, of course, are great for people that have got what I call the different ability of dyslexia.
Oh, why does that help, Tom?
Well, because dyslexic people are just wired slightly different. It's not that their wiring doesn't suit our conventional education system, which is why some of them struggle at school. But they've got brilliance in other ways. So, for example, when I'm working with severely dyslexic authors, I'll get them to speak their books, and they have no problem speaking the story and having fantastic recall of events and conversations that went on years before. I can't remember what I said about an hour ago, never mind last year or the year before that. But I've got great memory for things and facts and useless information.
Wow. We have a really good question in the chat room from Al Gary, and he said that it's believed that the temporal lobe plays a large part in paranormal experiences. Have you found that, or is it something you're yet to research?
Oh, no, I've done a lot of research. I've got two fantastic books written by a bloke called Emanuel Swedenborg 250 years ago. And Emanuel Swedenborg was an amazing mystic, Swedish mystic, and polymath. And he, just through dissection of cadavers and channeling, worked out what spiritual function virtually every bit of the brain had. And if you compare his notes that he did with no MRI scans, just probably a microscope, but that's all, with what people and I finding out using MRI scanners and people like at the heart math and what have you. It's amazing how he just channeled this in. It took me about 3 years to track these books, and I got one of the last copies from a site over in the States called Cerebrum. And he basically just induced what each brain structure did. And what you can do, I mean, can we go a bit more advanced? Is it okay if we get into a bit more detail?
They can always scream in the chat room.
They can scream, can't they? So, you know the way that you imagine the breath is going to one part of your brain or the other? You can also imagine your consciousness is going to one part of the brain or the other. And so you can move your consciousness around. And remember, Nikki, when I came and we did that, that workshop at the shop back in, I think it was October, wasn't it, or September? One of the meditations I do is actually getting to people to move their consciousness from their frontal lobes into the pineal gland. And when you do that, something amazing happens. The conventional human mind is only capable about having one thought at a time. So you have a think now about something, and then you think about that. What happens is the first thought disappears and gets replaced by the second thought.
Okay.
Right?
Yeah.
And this is called the quantum collapse of thought. And so what happens when you move to the pineal glands, you can run two or three thought streams at the same time. So I run my consciousness there from all the time. I want to talk about time as well in a minute, so just park that for now. But talking about slow brains, you can also speed up your brain as well and jump to different time continuums with it. And so what you can do by placing your consciousness in the pineal gland is you become an observer of your own thoughts. So you see, inverted commas, the thoughts, your own thought streams. And if you're working with a client, you also pick up some of their thought streams or thought streams of from external sources meant for them. So typically, a good example might be I'm working with a client non-spiritually, just working on their book. I can sort of have a full-on conversation with them about whatever we're doing, at the same time be receiving messages about what the perfect title for their book is going to be.
Now, I think that probably makes sense to us, doesn't it, Nikki? Because we can be up on a stage saying one thing and have something completely different becoming into our minds, can't we?
Yeah, and this is a natural state of mind. Shamans work like this all the time. And what's interesting is different parts of our body work at different speeds. I'll pick up that question about left-handed and right-handedness in a minute, if it's okay. But different parts of our bodies work at different speeds. So, for example, it's known now, and this has been measured on with MRI scanners, is that the gut mind, you know, there's more neurons in our gut than there are in a cat's brain. So it's a very intelligent mind, but we overrule it with our left brain. Okay, we've got a heart mind as well, we've got a root mind, we've got minds at all our chakra points, including the chakra points outside our body, and they're all working at different time continuums. So the gut mind works 5 or 10 seconds ahead. It's always right, but what we do, and we've all done it, including me, we overrule it, and we say things like, oh, I wish I'd gone with my gut on that one.
Mm-hmm.
Gut is always there. Your heart mind runs plus or minus 2 or 3 seconds ahead and behind your conscious mind. So you might fall in love with something slightly before you're consciously aware of it, and you might, after the event, go, oh, I really love that. Brilliant. Your throat mind runs half a second to a second behind the conscious mind. So we have a thought, and then about half a second later we speak it, even though we don't have this transatlantic delay when we're speaking. So for me to have a thought, to then speak it, for you to listen to it and then decode it, there should be naturally a 1 or 2 second delay. But in the same way that we invert the images in our eyes, this delay is just is being deleted, so we don't experience it anymore, which is just phenomenal. But we don't think about it.
So is that why sometimes we say, Tom, you know, I wish I could have said that, and I wish I'd said that.
Yeah. We're fighting with all our time continuums, if you know what I mean. And then you've got the minds outside our body that work outside space and outside time. So, which is why the people with their heads in the cloud are just kind of more tuned into them and really not grounded into our physical reality.
Wow.
Right.
And of course, if you do drugs, any sort of psychedelic drugs, you get into that state. Speed speeds you up. But one great trick you can do is to change the speed of your consciousness, so you get more than, like, in an hour's time, you get what looks like about 3 or 4 hours work done.
Right. So is that if you're really on fire and inspired about something, you can get lots and lots done because you synchronize yourself and speed yourself up.
Yeah. Well, your thought process is speeding up, so everything else looks like it's slow, but you've actually jumped outside time for a while. And the same trick is, you know, when you're late for an appointment, and somehow you get there with just like 30 seconds to spare. You don't know how you got there.
Yeah.
You can get in that same mode. And it happens in kind of physical reality as well. I don't quite know how that works, but it just seems to. So.
one of the things I find interesting is sometimes I can just be, give me a pen and paper, and I can be writing like the clappers, and then it just stops.
Okay.
It's as if there's been a thought stream there somewhere that I've either tuned into or tuned out of, obviously, and it just stops. And I can, mid-sentence, I can suddenly find myself completely uninspired. And sometimes that'll only happen to me 3 or 4 times in a year.
Mm. Well, your language is giving it away.
Go on.
You said the word uninspired.
Mm.
And inspiration, of course, is half the respiration process.
Oh.
So you probably find that when you did that, your breathing went shallow. Maybe some inner demons popped up, some doubt.
Breathing is something I don't tend to do a lot.
And we all don't. I'm as bad as everyone else at it, unless I'm demonstrating it. Or before I write, what I do is I do meditation and I breathe before the writing. Then I'll mind map what I'm about to write and then I'll write it. So I get into this state. Sometimes I doodle it as well. I doodle it. Even when I can't draw, I doodle it before. And just gets you into a different mode.
Have you ever found that, Nikki, you suddenly drop out?
Absolutely. Or you're trying to, you know, from when I start writing an article or something, I try and try, and the words aren't coming, and I can't think what to do next. And then suddenly there's a click, and 500 words will spill out on the page.
Mm-hmm.
And then, like you say, suddenly you'll take a breath and sort of think where you are, and you realise that this whole article has just downloaded and you can't really remember writing it.
Well, there was a very famous author, Terry Thomas. He wrote Stand Up Virgin Soldiers and things like that.
Mm-hmm.
And he was on Parkinson one night when I was quite a young woman, and Michael Parkinson said to him, how do you write a book? He said, well, it's like this. I wake up one morning and the whole book's there.
Mm-hmm.
I know the entire plot, beginning, middle and end. I know every character in it, including things that I might not even want to put in the book. He said, so then I write that book. And then I go and have some night's sleeps until I wake up another morning and the whole book's there again.
Mm-hmm.
And the first play I ever wrote, I saw Arsenic and Old Lace. And the particular performance I saw, the guy used to carry a teddy bear around. And as I looked at that teddy bear, I got an entire play from that teddy bear. And I would say I probably wrote that play 5 to 6 years later, but I never forgot it.
Yeah, and that's the great power of the mind, isn't it? Because this right brain of ours is tapped into what we call the collective consciousness. So if you think about the left brain, this is only... I'll come back to this left and right hand thing, because that's really important. Think about the left brain in most people as being the generator and perceiver of reality. And think about the right brain being the receiver of external thought, which is collective thought. But at the same time, we have that. Our heart mind and our gut mind also picks up other people's heart minds and gut minds. So you know instantly if you love another person, either in a kind of sexual connotation or just you love them because they're a lovely person. You instantly know if someone's lying, even though their words might sound very convincing. And that's your gut mind tuning into their gut mind, and their gut mind radiating, you know what, I'm telling a bit of a porcupine here. And with the heart mind, you know, you can tell if somebody doesn't really love things, and you're aware of it slightly before your conscious mind catches up with it. So our right brain, think about it as the receiver of thought, and the left brain as the generator of thought. But just to confuse things, they're both holographic pattern detectors, and you've got a hologram of your left brain inside your right brain, and a hologram of your right brain inside your left brain. But that can't be seen from our three space and time dimensions, but you can see it easily from external dimensions. So what happens is our right brains are tapped into every other one, everyone else's consciousness, past, present, and future, including your own consciousness. So the best way, you know about people that channel, obviously. The best way to channel your book is to channel your future self in those are the words you haven't written yet.
Yes, because I do feel like all my books are sitting on a bookshelf, and if I just read them, and I could write them.
Exactly. Well, that's one of the techniques that I teach.
Brilliant.
And I'd love to come to Glastonbury and do a How to Channel Yourself book writing workshop. How about that? Should we put that in our future timeline?
That could be fun.
Couldn't it?
Absolutely,
Yes.
I'll come. There's a question, Tom, in the chat room about people with high or low serotonin levels, saying that things like amphetamines have really adverse effects on someone with high or low serotonin levels, so schizophrenics. And they say that if they overstimulate or understimulate, then they have a reaction. It, how would that work if you were speeding your own brain up?
Well, good question. The honest answer is I don't really know, but I will
Okay.
say that the serotonin is not the cause, it's the symptom. So this is where conventional science has got it completely round the wrong way, is that it's not the serotonin that causes the state of mind, it's the state of mind that generates that serotonin.
Oh.
Right? Everything is round completely the wrong way. Another good example of that is, we think about our bodies generating the aura, don't we? But it's the other way around. The aura distills the body from the aura.
Right.
It
Say
could
that
be.
again.
So the
That's what I was
aura,
just going
it's not like that we have a body and it generates the aura, right?
to.
The aura is what the aura distills the body into physical reality.
So our aura makes our body real.
That's right.
Right.
I can feel that because without our aura, which to me is our esoteric energy, we wouldn't be here in the first place. The
For
body would
sure.
just be an organic lump of something
Yeah, which it
with
is when we
nothing to
die,
switch it
isn't it?
on. Yeah.
Yeah.
Wow. Now, we've got the left-handed, right-handed thing, Tom.
Oh,
And
yes.
also, I wanted you to talk a little bit more about food because I know there's at least one other person in the chat room, very much like me, very much affected by the food they eat and often describes their brain as being pure wool. So, whichever one you want to take first.
Well, let's do left and right hand because that's really quick to do. So not everybody's the same. So all these generalizations about left and right brain, even the one I just did about the left brain being the generator and the right brain being the receiver, that's only for most people. And what happens is they're flipping all the time anyway. So a bit of the left brain is the receiver sometimes, and the bit of the right brain is the generator. And for some people, they're wired completely differently. About 5% of the world population. Their left brain does what their right brain does, and vice versa. Right, and obviously the scientists haven't measured all 7 billion people, so you can do that. And then some people that are left-handed have some of the motor functions that are normally in the left brain in the right brain, and vice versa. And then some people are completely cross-wired. So we're all different. And some people also were left-handed at school. But the school system forced them to be right-handed. And some people are completely ambidextrous. As the old joke says, I'd give my right hand to be ambidextrous. So, so everyone's kind of different. And then we can maybe segue into this food thing. Everyone's also got a completely different set of tolerances as well. So I think the best thing to do is to go and get tested by somebody who is very good at allergies, like a kinesiologist. And what they can do is they can help you get into the different states of mind and find out what, just by muscle testing and putting the various samples onto one of your drainage points, your neurolymphatic drainage points, they can actually induce that state of wooliness. And you might find that it's actually really is. Two bottles of brandy make your head go very woolly, so just keep off the brandy. Or being more flippant, it could be pasta, or it could be foods at different times of the day, or different times of the year, or different times of the moon cycle.
Wow.
Yeah.
Crikey.
So we're much more interdependent on everything that's external to us than we think. And one of the biggest things that we're dependent on is water. So if you are stuck writing, go out and go for a walk. You can go for a walk near water as well. Water is the conductor of the universal mind stuff, and that's where all our memories are stored, and it's where all the collective memories are stored as well. So walking near water. Some people, loads of people I know, mostly women, funny enough, report also going for a pee stimulates their inspiration.
I must take a notepad with me.
There you go. Yeah, always have a notepad in the loo. Yeah.
Yeah, very good. What do you think about Gary's question about hypnotic regression, Tom? That's an interesting
one. Oh, I didn't see
one.
That one. Can I go back and look at that one? Hang on.
Found out an interesting fact. It's I think it's the last sort of big paragraph in the chat room.
Is it?
Got up a little bit. It's about hypnotic regression.
Yeah.
When investigating UFO abduction.
Yeah.
It's very unreliable, apparently, hypnotic regression. What do you think?
So, I don't know the answer off the top of my head, so let me just tune in. So this is the thing. The thing about being in this state is that a lot of the stuff that I've done, you can't find in a book anywhere. So, like, for example, I wanted to know the mechanism for a light bulb moment. And what I did, I just tuned in and got given it by someone upstairs. And I knew I didn't know the answer, therefore... Because what came in seemed right to me, and my gut told me it was right, and my heart fell in love with it, and then at the end of it, my brain went, well, it must be right then. So, but what I didn't do was put my brain in the way and my ego in the way. Well, that's a good example of a nested question, right? There's actually about two or three questions in there. So hypnotic regression, does it work? Yes. Unreliable when people have new abduction cases. Well, is UFO abduction true or not, right? Is it a figment of the imagination or is it real? And is UFO abduction different from just abduction? And is abduction different from tuning into external entities? Because I've got to tell you, I get interfered a lot with at night, right? That's not rude, but I have what looks like abduction happening a lot, which is more like reprogramming from beings which are outside our time dimensions. Now, if I believed in UFOs, I would put a UFO slant on that. Therefore, it might taint what is really going on. Therefore, under hypnotic regression, I would sound not convincing, or I might be confused. Because I'm making the assumption that the thing that's actually happening is to do with little green men and UFOs and this sort of stuff. And I have been dragged off into many, many out-of-body experiences. But I'm not saying that it's UFOs. I think that it's to do with the fact that we work in three dimensions and we've got creatures and beings and consciousnesses at lower dimensions, at one dimension and two dimensions, like the fairies in the elf realm. And above that, we've got beings at sort of five, six, seven, eight, nine dimensions. And the way that we interact with them is sometimes in our sleep. But I'm not saying they're UFOs. And therefore, if I was to be regressed and start to spin a kind of UFO yarn, then I'd be having all sorts of conflicts with myself because I'd know in my gut and my heart I was telling a lie, but only because I didn't know what the truth was. Now, does that answer the question or is that too vague?